Film reviews, as usual, on a Thursday night with me in studio this evening, Deirdre Malumbi and Dave Hanratty, who have been to the cinema for us. Now, you might think that if the world was going to end, you couldn't find yourself in better company than a troupe of hilarious clowns that will laugh you over the edge. While Irish film Apocalypse Clown begs to differ, you might also think that living life footloose and fancy free, loving who you want and when you want would be heaven. Iris Sachs' film Passages is a cautionary tale. And something else you might think, that if you were a retired assassin, you'd find peace and quiet in Sicily. Think again, you wouldn't. And neither does The Equalizer, who is back for a third time. Let's begin close to home in a post-apocalyptic world where you might be trapped in a road trip with a group of clans. That is the scenario dreamed up by co-writer and director George Kane with his new film Apocalypse Clown. The mix makes pretty unhinged and unpredictable apocalyptic clown, that kind of film. As I said, Deirdre Malumbi and Dave Hanratty with me in studio this evening. It all begins, Deirdre, with a clown funeral and a solar flare.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, this movie is just kind of one mad, strange, surreal incident after another. They also end up in a hippie commune with Tony Cantwell, who we'll all kind of immediately recognise. So, yeah, this is just kind of one of those madcap type of movies. It starts with this strange technological blackout which sweeps across Ireland, plunging it into a sort of apocalypse. Chaos and anarchy breaks out everywhere. And yeah, we followed this primarily this troupe of luckless clowns. There are three of them, Bobo, Pepe and Funzo, who decide now that society has been forced to regress, to, you know, turn to traditions. Now that technology isn't immediately available, this could be their chance to rise to success and fame at long last, because they've been quite luckless so far in their careers.
I mean, the premise here is quite extraordinary. And those three names, Bobo, Pepe and Funzo, it sounds as if they just might... Are these generic clowns or are they very different types of clowns, David?
Very broadly individually drawn and also all uniquely terrible at their craft, it should be said as well. So you got David Earle as Bobo, ostensibly our leading clown, struggling alcoholic,
following
hard
times. You'd know David Earle from things like Afterlife and Derek and Brian and Charles. Very particular look he has, doesn't he? Really?
Yeah, he works well here as the kind of bedraggled, like I say, fallen on hard times kind of guy who's, you know, just, you know, he's at the end of his tether. You know, his act isn't working anymore. He's on the kind of the terminal ward in a children's hospital and they're kind of like, you've had it, man. It's not really working. So, you know, off you go. You got Fionn Foley, rising Irish actor, as Pepe, this kind of deeply insecure and notably pretentious mime artist who witnesses the death of his mentor, who's his mentor for all of 2 minutes, witnesses his act, doesn't like it to the point that he dies on the spot. But Pepe is so, you know, beholden to this man that he vows to give him a proper funeral, which goes wrong. And then you got Natalie Palomides, who's an American actress and also a professional clown. So I think she's perfect for this role. She's Funzo, the most psychotic of the bunch. She's vaguely Eastern European, recently escaped from a mental asylum and boasts a fondness for knives. She's devoted to the renegade art of street clowning and makes some enemies in the opening sequence who will then chase her across the rest of the movie. So they're all, you know, quite individual.
And everything that both of you have said for the last 5 or 6 minutes, the plot and the scenario becomes more and more outrageous and more ridiculous. I know that I'm a bit jealous now that Fionn Foley, the actor, and George Kane, the director, were in with Kay talking about this film. It has a lot going for it on the basis of what the both of you have set up so far, Deirdre.
Yeah, it does. And yet it doesn't always kind of work. I will say this for it. It is totally unique and it's very much taking a lot of risks. I think that when you look at the work of those three actors, David Earle, Fionn Foley and Palomides, I think that there must have been a lot of improv happening with the script, because from what I can see, they are kind of bouncing off each other really well. And I would say that being on the set was an absolute hoot. Now, the circumstances in which I watched this movie, I ended up watching it on my own, and I feel like I really wish that I had been surrounded by an audience. I feel like it is that type of movie, because it does have a very kind of, I suppose, quirky, unique sense of humor, which for me didn't always work. But then there were like certain scenarios and situations that were absolutely just so insane. For example, there's a final face-off in a circus tent, which I don't want to give away too much about, but just all of the events that were happening in that scene, I did find myself chuckling along because I was like, this is just so insane. You're
so sitting by yourself chuckling.
Yes.
It has to be said. Let's listen to a clip which features the aforementioned Funzo, played by Natalie Palamides. Very particular look that she has. And Fionn Foley, as Pepe, asks her if she is aware of the notorious clown whom she resembles.
Look, I don't mean to pry, but does anyone ever tell you you remind them of a certain Stephen King novel?
What's a Stephen King novel?
Right. Have you seen It?
What?
It. Have you seen It?
Have I seen what?
It. It's a film. It.
Yes, I've seen a film. I've seen, Babe, Pig in the City changed my life.
Yeah, right, well, it's like Babe, except instead of a pig, it's a clown. And instead of really wanting to herd sheep, he really wants to murder children.
Fionn Foley there as Pepe and Natalie Palamides as the clown Funzo, rather, in that clip from the film Apocalypse Clown. Even the title, I have to say, makes me smile on this one, Dave.
It's a good title, yeah, it must be said. And the premise is ingenious in its respects. But I mean,
I thought I heard a big bus coming.
It's tricky because, like, this isn't a $300 million Hollywood blockbuster. It's an independent Irish production, and you want to admire the craft and you want to forgive certain kind of budgetary constraints and that kind of stuff. But it does feel kind of almost too small scale. I don't think they really got across the level of devastation that is meant to have happened. And you hear in that clip there as well, the interplay, it really is Your Mileage May Vary. And I think the commitment is there without question from the actors, those two in particular. They ran away with the film for me. But you will, you know, the Marmite level performance there, particularly from, you hear the voice that Natalie Palamides is doing, and that might be nails on a chalkboard to you. I admired her commitment to the role. I just thought the material let them all down. I didn't think it was funny, and it's a comedy, and that's a problem for me.
You want to be laughing at a comedy, that's for sure. Did it work overall for you, Deirdre?
Yeah, I would kind of second what Dave was saying there, in that I think it was really Fionn Foley and Natalie Palamides that were carrying the film. Anyone else who's familiar with the work of David Earl from the likes of Brian and Charles, Afterlife, and Derek, I think that he does have a tendency to play the exact same character again and again. He's kind of the sad, pathetic, grotesque, middle-aged man who's always cracking one-liners. And for my money, I'm just a bit kind of fed up of seeing that character again and again. Although I was kind of glad to see at least we didn't have the storyline of the woman falls for him anyway. You know, one of the things that I quite enjoyed about the character of Jenny Malone is that she is permanently repulsed by him, and back from that.
I should have mentioned the character of Jenny, who's played by Amy DeBruyne. She's a, not Amy de Bruyne, Amy de Bruyne is an actor, obviously. Jenny is a journalist. Is that important to the plot, Dave, just as you give us
It's one character too many, I think, and she's as madcap and as broadly drawn as the clowns, and it's this kind of, you know, satire about digital media, and it's just really bottom of the barrel stuff. I mean, this is written by four people, and I found that absolutely baffling because the jokes often don't work. The pacing of the film is all over the place. It becomes incoherent. The performances saved it to some degree, but at the same time, by the end of it, I genuinely found it quite mind-numbing.
There were some moments where, you know, the clowns are kind of questioning their purpose and whether their life has any meaning at all. You know, even when they have this kind of clown in class at the start of the film, he's talking about how, you know, the art of being a clown is all about life, you know, because laughter is the only sane response to a meaningless existence. I feel like if they kind of maybe leaned into those more profound questions, it could have been maybe a more interesting movie here.
A little bit kind of apocalyptic Beckett, there's any other kind of Beckett. All right. Stars from you, Deirdre, on this?
I'm going to give it 2.5 out of 5 stars. I do think that it's one that you'd want to watch with an audience to get the full comedic effect.
All right, what are you saying, Dave?
It's 1.5 from me, unfortunately. I will keep an eye on the career of both Fionn Foley and Natalie Palamides because they clearly have a lot of talent, but that's enough clowning for me.
All right, very clear what you thought of that one, Dave. Let's move on then to Iris Sachs's latest work called Passages. This is the American director who was also on the programme when I was off on my holidays. He said this story centres on a married couple. Is it Thomas or Tomas, by the way?
Thomas, I believe.
Thomas. And Martin, whose love is brutally undermined when Tomas enters into an affair with a younger woman he meets in a nightclub. this is a film about narcissism, but I'm told it's a sexy film about narcissism. Is this true, Deirdre?
Yeah, it's a bit of both, I suppose. Yeah, for me, the film really kind of centres on the character of Thomas, who is this fussy filmmaker. He's very particular about what he wants. You know, he's a filmmaker, and in the film's very first scene, he's kind of, you know, making a big deal about someone's wine glass, and he's shouting at a man about how he's walking down the stairs. So we're very much centred on this character. Yeah. His husband, Martin, is also kind of fussy, but he's also a very kind of sharp man, and he's very like hopelessly in love with Thomas. And I think that really the journey that this film takes is looking at this almost like a menage a trois. Thomas is having an affair with Agathe, who is played by Adele Exarchopoulos, who people will recognise from Blue is the Warmest Colour, as well as kind of trying to maintain this relationship with Martin. Basically, he can't decide, and he wants to end up with both, I suppose.
You can't have your cake and eat it, Thomas. I think that's true, no matter what you work at. And here he is working as a director in the film Passages, basically telling this actor, stop acting, just move for the way I tell you. I've heard directors speak like this before, you know.
Stop. It's not that you have to come down the staircase. You want to come down the staircase. It's not even about the staircase. It's about you going to have a drink, going to have some fun. This is just a transition moment. But we are turning it into a huge drama moment because you're not able to make some simple steps down the staircase. Everybody's waiting for you. Just make your steps. Just walk down a staircase. It's not that hard. I don't want you to, I don't want you to show us your physical problems. I just want you to come down the staircase, see the space. It's a place that you've known for a while and you like it. And you're going in the space and you're going to order a drink and you have a cigarette and you like it because it's your favorite blunt, okay?
Okay.
Great.
Wow, there's direction for you. That's Franz Rogowski as the character of Thomas in the film Passages, and clearly Dave Hanratty in that. I don't know whether that's Ira Sachs having a bit of a go at actors in the writing of the script, but there's a bit of fun being knocked out of it. But we see just how kind of controlling character within all of that as well, isn't he, the character of Thomas?
So multi-layered, and even in that sequence, the film that they're shooting is itself called Passages, which I wonder was a nod, Ira Sachs, to himself perhaps. Right. So like Franz Rogowski is an incredible actor, wonderful and incredible here. I first saw him in a film called Victoria a few years ago, a one-take masterpiece that everyone listening to this should check out. Here he plays an absolute monster, but monsters are real. This is the thing. Mm. And they're complex. And, you know, you see him on the set there, and despite the fact that he is definitely very commanding and maybe a bit hysterical in a way, he knows what he wants. But in his personal life, he does not know what he wants.
Yeah.
And that's the problem. And he displays a Herculean lack of empathy in this motion picture, which it affects everyone around him to such a degree. And what's interesting about this is that this film is full of melancholy and sadness, but as we heard in that clip, it's also very funny.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I must say I found that particular passage quite funny. But then let's listen to another clip. Again, it finishes Rogowski for the most part here, but you'll also hear Ben Whishaw. So they're married, the pair of them, and Franz, the character of Thomas, is coming home to tell his husband about what he's been getting up to in the evening time when he's not coming home.
Martin?
Mm-hmm.
You know what I was doing last night?
No, but whatever it was, you sound very excited.
I had sex with a woman. Can I tell you about it, please?
Yes, of course.
I felt something I hadn't felt in a very long time, and
it was... I wanted to hear this.
It was exciting. It was something different. It's sick what's happening between us. For real. You hate me, don't you?
Can you not do this now?
Leave my suitcase alone.
That's Franz Rogowski and Ben Whishaw in a scene there from Passages, directed by Iris Sachs. Poor Al Paddington. He's going to be very sore hurt after all of this, Deirdre.
I am the exact same. I can't see Ben Whishaw in anything without thinking of Paddington Bear now. But he's really great in this as Martin. I mean, you would have even heard in that scene there where Thomas is telling Martin about the affair. He is understandably annoyed and upset. And Thomas has this very lackadaisical attitude to the fact that he has been unfaithful to his husband. And later on in the film, he kind of chastises Martin. He says he isn't trying hard enough. He says Agatha, you know, excites him. And he even goes as far as asking Martin to feel happy for him. And it's just quite extraordinary. He's so bursting with self-entitlement and he's so convincing in this conviction that his behaviour is not just acceptable, but it's admirable, that he'd almost convince you that that's true.
However, essentially, we are talking about, it's not quite a three-hander, but it depends on the three central performances. We've talked about Ben Whishaw and Franz Rogowski. What about Adele Exarchopoulos, who in the midst of all of this?
It's a heartbreaking performance, and she gets the most heartbreaking line in the film, which I will not spoil right here, but it is a film in which small sentences can have a big emotional effect. And what's interesting, you know, you mentioned at the start of this review that this is a very sexy film about narcissism, and it is. It's multi-layered. It's all those things, but it's very sexy in the sense that you have these three physically very beautiful people, but they're doing the ugliest emotional things to each other, whether it's directly or even indirectly. Everyone is quote unquote guilty to some extent in this situation because they're all being very selfish, and at a certain point that has to have consequences. I will say though, to go back to your point, all the players here are brilliant, and Adele Exarchopoulos has a very difficult job because she's kind of the, you know, the more interesting kind of barrier that comes between these people. She's magnificent. Everyone here really is though.
Yeah, but a lot of talk around the very explicit sex scenes in this film, Deirdre. It got the NC-17 whatever classification in the in the US, which means nobody under the age of 17 can see this, whether they're accompanied by an adult or not. Was that merited, first of all, and how gratuitous or otherwise are the sex scenes? I've read something from Iris Sachs. He was quite irate at that NC-17 classification.
I think it's absolutely deserved in this case. I personally found the sex scenes in this quite explicit, but they are also, like, you know, there is kind of the sexiness to them, and there is that, you know, exciting nature, I suppose, in
and
having
an affair. Is there gender equality in the explicitness of the sex scenes?
Yes, there is, and I mean especially, you know, with regards to the portrayal of, you know, homosexuality, let alone like homosexual intimacy. You get both of those there. There's kind of not too much to talk about it without getting super explicit and stuff like that, but safe to say, the sex scenes are quite in your face.
How did you feel about the nature of those sex scenes? Were they gratuitous, Dave?
Not one bit, no. I thought it was much more intimate than explicit, really. I mean, sure, you don't see it every day, but we have this kind of interesting kind of conversation about generational attitudes, and are younger people more turned off by sex scenes? Well, if they are, well, then they're going to struggle with this. But at the same time, it's got a 16 rating here, which I was glad to see. I mean, I thought maybe we'd get
an
18.
Should it have an 18, or would you thought that it was an 18?
Potentially, but I mean, it all matters. It's all contextual. It makes sense for these characters to behave in the way that they do. And like I say, I mean, like, you don't see an adult drama like this in the cinema every day. I do want people to go see this film because
it does sound multi-layered from what you're both saying.
Definitely, yeah. I think that there's nothing wasted, and it is a short film. It's only 90 minutes as well, and I think that they, you know, you need to see how these people live their lives. You need to see how they behave.
And they are kind of bohemian life in Paris, so yeah, you might expect a little bit of an explicit nature to the sex scenes. Okay, stars from you on this one, Dave.
It's a 3.5, potentially 4 on a rewatch. I thought it was lacking something that I can't quite put my finger on, but the fault might be mine. It was just a weird thing where, like, it gets to the ending scene and I sat there and I was like, oh, this is the ending. I wanted a bit more from it. But the performances are incredible. These are three brilliant actors at the top of their game.
What are you saying overall in this one, Deirdre, and stars?
Yeah, I'd kind of be between a 3.5 and 4 as well. It kind of had a weird a sense of time for me in that it felt like a slow burner, but also things were moving along really, really fast. Like, suddenly Thomas falling in love with Agatha and he's moving in with her. I think the messiness and pain that Thomas causes in the end is like monumental, and it's really heartbreaking to see how events turn out, and it's quite beautiful as well. It's a great character study, and it's open to different interpretations, which I think is a sign of a really strong film as well.
So both of you in the 3.5 to 4 bracket, and saying it merits a second viewing from what you're both talking about. Yes, looking forward to seeing that one for sure. Let's move on then to film number 3, The Equalizer 3. It finds retired assassin Robert McCall, played by Denzel Washington, living in the south of Italy, but day-to-day activity does not seem to have changed much for The Equalizer, as the opening scene sees him massacre his way through a vineyard. Is this the only way up or down from there, Dave, in terms of the equalizer setup here?
Down, in many respects.
Right, okay, what are we talking about here? Are we looking at a fight for social justice and just moving to the beautiful backdrop of Italia?
Yeah, it's a bit of that. And we're also talking about Denzel Washington making the curious decision to not just reprise this character in 2018 and thus, you know, doing his first ever sequel, but now his first ever trilogy. And I'm like, really, Denzel? This character? Like, Denzel Washington is amazing. I'd watch him do anything.
Yeah.
And the first couple of Equalizer movies are trashy fun in a way, but the character is bizarre. He's this ex-government agent who settles down and wants to just help people, but he helps people by murdering people in the most vicious and inventive and elaborate of ways. So you have this weird juxtaposition contrast where, in, you know, he's friends of the community over here, but psycho killer over there. And the films are not interested in interrogating that whatsoever. In this one, there is a moment early on where, you know, he's recovering from some bullet wounds and a kindly Italian doctor, he's having a conversation with him and he says, you know what you asked me when you first got here? You asked me, am I a good man or a bad man? And I was like, oh, amazing. They're actually finally going to talk about how much of a psycho this guy is. And then the kindly old doctor just goes, only a good man would ask that question. And then that's it. That's it. Let's get back to the discussion. Murder. That's it.
There are Syrian drug smugglers in town. I mean, I'm slightly disturbed by the, is there a stereotypical thing going on in that aspect of this film?
I mean, if that was kind of something, I don't think that's something that they considered at all, to be honest. I think that these those characters could have been of any nationality, really. I mean, when it comes to kind of the ensemble cast members, whether they are the ones who are playing the gang members or the cast members, you know, none of them particularly like stand out. Like, this movie could have been set absolutely anywhere with characters from absolutely any nationality. It doesn't matter. It is just one of these like shoot 'em up action movies. And to add to you know, Dave's point there about why does Denzel Washington pick this franchise? I mean, to me, the character of Robert McCall kind of reminds me of, say, Liam Neeson's character from the Taken franchise. Now, his name is Brian Mills, but no one remembers that. It's Liam Neeson in the Taken movies. And I think that that's similar with Denzel Washington in the Equalizer movies.
You're saying we don't particularly remember the name Robert McCall. Let's listen to Robert McCall. Now, you may have had an older brother, or let us be fair, an older sister, an older sibling, who was fond of squeezing your finger until you screamed back in the day. Or you may not. You may have been that older brother or older sibling. Let's listen to Robert McCall with a kind of a variation on that technique. He's meeting a local thug here, a character called Gio Bonocchi, played by Eugenio Mastroianni. They're in a restaurant. Things get heated and McCall starts squeezing the finger. There is a bit of unsavoury language towards the end of this, but, you know, after all, he's getting his finger squeezed.
You like being in other people's business?
I'm really beginning to like this place and the people. I'm starting to believe from the bottom of my heart that this is where I'm supposed to be. So, whatever it is that you and your friends do, please, do it somewhere else.
You warning me?
I'm preparing you.
Hai capito che ha detto? E si sta preparando, è simpatico.
Is that a Timex?
No. It's a
right there. Right there.
Ma sentate, va! Sentate!
That's the median nerve that I'm compressing. On a scale from 1 to 10, that's a 2. That's a 3. You don't want me to go to 4. I go to 4, you shit on yourself. You don't want that. I don't want that. They don't want that. Tell your compadres that they can leave. On the bed.
Maria! Maria!
Denzel Washington squeezing the finger of Gio Bonocchi there in a scene from The Equalizer 3. We were talking about gratuitous sex scenes in the previous, or the possibility of gratuitous sex scenes, I should say, in the previous film, Dave. Have we got gratuitous violence here, even if it is only finger squeezing?
That's our hero. We do, and we had them in the first film and the second one as well, but they've really ramped it up here as well, and that's kind of one of the only reasons to buy a ticket.
In the first Equalizer and the second Equalizer.
Oh, yeah. I mean, like some genuinely sadistic Hannibal Lecter, Michael Myers-esque stuff that you're just like, why? And yeah, and this one, like, it's just so strange. Like, it's the kind of violence where I, at one point, like, something happened and I just out loud went, Jesus. I was like, why are we doing this? And the character's so weird. He's superhuman. There's no tension at all. These characters don't stand up to him whatsoever. They're just waiting their turn to get horribly killed. I think what we have here is, you know, Denzel's making these movies with a director called Anton Fuqua, who he worked with on Training Day, and he's made the other Equalizer movies. Yeah. And they're clearly friends, and it's a comfortable job for him. I think not having Tony Scott in the world anymore, like, they made five films together. We might be getting thrillers there, and they would still be, you know, not amazing. Yeah. But they'd be better than this. This feels like he's just kind of slumming it for a paycheck, and I found that very sad to see. So, I mean, as well, I should say as well, when I saw this movie, half the dialogue's in Italian. The screening I saw had no subtitles, and I've seen this reported elsewhere. There's clearly some glitch going on, but it doesn't matter. It absolutely doesn't matter.
But should we go and see it anyway, if it's had even without subtitles?
I wouldn't rush out. I mean, maybe wait for streaming.
Okay, stars?
1.5
1.5 Yeah. And you're even doubting that one. What are you saying, Deirdre?
Well, see, I like popcorn action.
So do I.
Like dumb movies. And I think as a revenge action thriller, this movie is perfectly serviceable. It is conventional. It is forgettable. Denzel Washington's presence alone, I think, absolutely sells it. I'd give it 3 stars on the basis of its genre.
All right, 3 stars on the basis of a genre. A bit of a qualification there. That's for the film The Equalizer 3. And Deirdre Malombe and Dave Hanratty is previously speaking to us about Passages and Apocalypse Clown. Released this week in 1973, Marvin Gaye's Let's Get It On album was quite a departure from his socially conscious concept recording What's Going On, which he released just a couple of years previously. Let's Get It On, with its smooth production, unashamed highlighting of Marvin Gaye's velvety voice and innate sexuality, the album paved the way for a new wave of artists, people like Barry White, Isaac Hayes, and a little later on, you could even put in the likes of Prince, I think it's safe to say. DJ Stevie G, also known as Stephen Granger, has been listening back to Let's Get It On, and he's here to talk about the impact of the album. But even Stevie, as I was playing it today, and even it's the opening track, the title track, Let's Get It On, and the minute you put it on, it's so smooth, it's so velvety, it's hard not just to smile and bop along with it, isn't it?
Yeah, I was bopping my head here, and there might have even been some hips shaking down here in Cork as well. But yeah, absolutely, and the fact that we're talking about it 50 years later is a good testament to the song and the album. But I think that song in particular never fails, no matter what. As a DJ, for example, you could put it on in pretty much any kind of party and it will work. So yeah. What a track.
Yeah, and if I suppose I should have said to you, Stevie, that you're joining us from Cork this evening. We need to put it in the context, though, of the album that it came out of, if you like, the previous album, What's Going On, which was a very different style of album, certainly lyrically and in terms of the themes that Marvin Gaye was dealing with. It was an altogether more serious album, if that's the right way of putting it. Certainly a more socially conscious album, the previous album.
Yeah, on the surface, you definitely, and I always looked at them as being kind of almost polar opposites. Mm. I mean, there is the similarity in the titles, the What's Going On, which actually wasn't a question, it was actually a statement,
yeah.
And the Let's Get It On. But I mean, it looked like a departure from the kind of the world view, the socially conscious political album. And ironically, I mean, we talked a lot about it because it was the 50th anniversary of What's Going On a couple of years ago. We would have talked a lot about it then, which is, I mean, everyone would admit it is probably one of the top 10 albums of all time, my favourite certainly, but even if you look at that from a political point of view, there's a lot of social stuff, but even from an ecological point of view, that album was just incredible. But this album, I've been as time has gone on, I've been kind of looking more about the similarities. So Let's Get It On again was another concept, again probably more spiritual, more for the bedroom than the kind of the universal kind of situation when it comes to the social view of the world. But musically, it was also like, if you look at Marvin Gaye, he was having hits all through the 60s, as were all the other soul artists from Motown or whatever, but it was the first time they really started looking at the album as an album as a whole. So I think a lot of these artists were looking at the Beatles and the Stones and kind of looking at albums Whereas previously, I mean, I'd be a huge Marvin Gaye fan, but I couldn't name an album in the 60s. Yeah. It was almost like a greatest hits or whatever. It was all built their own singles. So this happened at the same time as Stevie Wonder, Curtis Mayfield, all of these people were really looking at the album as a format. And the album flows really well as a format. There's not a lot of filler on it. It's about 8 or 9 tracks.
Yeah,
or whatever.
8 tracks. I was kind of amazed when I put that on again today. Well, boy, it's only 8 tracks, but he packs quite a lot into the 8 tracks. What about the role of Berry Gordy in the midst of all of this, who was the, you know, the supremo at Motown, the record label at that time? What role did he play in this, one could argue, change of direction from Marvin Gaye?
Yeah, absolutely. So Berry Gordy was the guy who had the vision of looking at what I just described as a production line, really, because Detroit was famous for producing cars, and he took the same view in the 60s, and it really worked. You had songwriters, you had all sorts of, you'd have one room, people would be doing the choreography, you'd have songwriters, there'd be the musicians, the Funk Brothers, who actually backboned this album from Marvin and the previous album. So there's obviously that kind of correlation as well. But I think the likes of Marvin Gaye and Stevie Wonder, who was only probably, Stevie Wonder was only about 22 at the time, he managed to secure, there was a lot of talk about him leaving the label, but he managed to secure the kind of creative control, and that really helped Marvin do the same, really. And when What's Going On, he didn't want to release What's Going On. Berry Gordy didn't really kind of see the vision. He was content to just keep doing the singles. But I think when Stevie Wonder and Marvin Gaye at the same time were getting a bit of success, it led to some creative control. Now, this was another huge smash, which gave him even more creative control. But Berry Gordy, I think the money talked in the end. He had the vision first day. He wouldn't have had the vision like often happens when it comes to, and a lot of these young artists, like Marvin Gaye was in his 30s at the time, but Stevie was very young. They were kind of steadfast, trying to really get that autonomy, which helped change the game, as you mentioned earlier. Yeah. The likes of Prince wouldn't have happened if it wasn't for these albums.
And I've just wondered, you know, you're saying about Marvin Gaye kind of wrestling the control, or managing to get the artistic control, maybe taking that away from Berry Gordy, because there was a relationship there by marriage. He was Marvin Gaye was married at that time to Berry Gordy's sister, isn't that? Is that the relationship?
Yeah, Anna Gordy, who was much older than Marvin, so she was one of Berry's sisters. And it was just one more complication. You can hear a lot of it in this album.
Yeah.
You can particularly hear it in the famous breakup album. Now, they broke up pretty much around this time, but as part of the divorce proceedings, Marvin had to record an album and give the royalties to Anna, which became Here My Dear, which is another classic. We'll probably talk about that in its 50th anniversary in a few years.
In a few years' time.
But it was very complex, and there was a lot of other complex issues when it comes to Marvin, who was a kind of a sex symbol even in the 60s, but a kind of a reluctant one. So even at the time of the recording of this, he's going around wearing jeans and a woolly hat. He looked like something from the Clancy Brothers, rather than a kind of...
But there was again, there's a difficult or a worth mentioning family dynamic involved there as well, in that Marvin Gaye's relationship with his own father was quite difficult. The father was a preacher, very much against the kind of sexual antics, as he would have put it, that Marvin Gaye seemed to be singing about. I mean, I think it's fairly clear what he's singing about when he says, let's get it on. But that story's not without its twists and turns, the father story.
Yeah, and it wouldn't have been new in soul and R&B, whether it was Sam Cooke or Aretha, there would have been a lot of artists wrestling with this. But there was an extra complication with Marvin's dad. Marvin Sr. was particularly very much on the kind of... he was always having a go at him for doing this secular music, and he was abusive when Marvin was a kid to his mother, and physically abusive to Marvin as well. And there was other complex situations. Marvin always, like, he saw his dad cross dressing and stuff, so he was always kind of wrestling with difficult kind of psychological problems, whatever. So he does kind of lay it bare here. It's almost like a spiritual kind of like a lot of the bedroom music, we'll say, even soul music, it can be really kind of like like tacker, tacky or saccharine or whatever, and we know what it sounds like when it goes wrong. And sadly, the likes of Barry White and even Isaac Hayes, sometimes they've got a, like people kind of joke about their music or their production. Well, not their production, but the likes of Marvin, I would never hear anyone sort of dismissing it. It's just so authentic and real. And even when he's talking about stuff that it's very hard to talk about this kind of these kind of themes without sounding like you have to really be feeling it. But I think that relationship, and again, I think there was a lot of stuff that happened later in the 70s when Marvin delved deeper into the personal problems and the drugs and all that. It kind of unraveled. But I think during this time, and it's interesting that some of these tracks were recorded concurrently with the What's Going On. So they were kind of left over.
Yeah.
They were left over. There was an album in between. There was actually two albums in between. So there was Trouble Man, which is like a blaxploitation soundtrack, largely instrumental. And then there was an album which only properly surfaced recently, You're the Man. So there was a couple of socially conscious tracks on that, like Where Are We Going and The World Is Rated X. But so I think Marvin was looking for a theme, and he was kind of, even when he was presented with the song If I Die Tonight, he was like, there was a different songwriter who helped produce this album, co-wrote it or whatever, and Marvin didn't really believe in it because it was one of these songs that was about if you meet this woman and if you die tonight you're going to be happy. And then he actually did meet that woman during these sessions when he was split up from Anna, and she became the subject, and then he really kind of sort of went 100%.
Yeah,
and she became the subject of I Want You as well, another great album which followed a few later years
on. Later. But I think in the penultimate track on the album we're talking about this evening, Let's Get It On, the penultimate track is You Sure Love to Ball. You know, it's an innocent enough phrase, kind of. Did it cause trouble at the time?
I think there was definitely trouble. Like, I would argue, and I think they're right, like, from a feminist point of view, there's some of the stuff on this album which is problematic. But I think radio on both sides of the Atlantic, from the research I did during the week, kind of embraced it. And it definitely changed the game. As I mentioned, Prince, but even if you want to look at the production techniques, the vocal stacking, like 20 years later.
Just explain Lauryn Hill, that term, vocal stacking.
Yeah, like, I mean, I'm looking at a desk now with whatever, 8 channels. There would have been sort of 2 or 3 channels back in the day. You record your vocal, you record your music or whatever. But as the technology was progressing, there was different channels for different bits of vocal. And someone as vocally talented as Marvin Gaye, and that's what Marvin Gaye is. He's got arguably the greatest voice of all time when it comes to music. You could basically put different versions of Marvin Gaye on the same track, and he stacked them and basically backed himself on all the tracks except one on this album. Lauryn Hill very much did it on The Miseducation of Lauryn Hill, D'Angelo, people like that. And even if you want to look at 2023, people like SZA, or even there's a lot of Irish people in the neo-soul scene doing some really good stuff, like Cubana. There's a lot of really cool young artists kind of. And I think Marvin Gaye really paved the way for that kind of style.
Yeah, you've given us a sense there of the legacy of the album is quite huge. But we'll finish up with You Sure Love to Ball. Is this, how does this track, I really like Let's Get It On, I have to say. It kind of epitomises the album. But this one is fairly exemplary as well in the way it treats the whole subject of the bedroom.
Yeah, I mean, it's the production. Again, this is a more sophisticated sound in the 70s. Black music became more sophisticated and lush. And you can really see where disco is starting to happen here as well. Philadelphia soul is happening. And it's not like just kind of like bang, bang in the 60s, if you pardon the pun. This is more of a kind of a lush production and a brilliant vocal again by Marvin.
Thanks, Stevie.
Thank you.
There you go. You Sure Love to Ball, the title of the track there from Marvin Gaye and his album Let's Get It On, which was turns 50 this week, in fact. And it was DJ Stevie G who was speaking to us about that Marvin Gaye album. Set in an epic fantasy world, the first series of The Wheel of Time followed Moraine, played by Rosamund Pike, a member of the incredibly all-powerful female organisation called Aes Sedai. She embarked on a dangerous world-spanning journey with five young villagers, one of whom is prophesied to be the Dragon Reborn, the one who will enter, save or destroy, will either save, I beg your pardon, or destroy humanity. The Wheel of Time is based on Robert Jordan's best-selling novels, which are among the most popular and enduring fantasy book series of all times, worth over 90 million copies have been sold. Aoife Barry has been watching The Wheel of Time and she's going to explain all of it to me between now and 8
don't
o'clock.
Make me.
I watched the first episode today and it started off, you know, with, as I also talked previously on ER.
It
started off with in previously on The Wheel of Time. I thought, oh, this is great. It's going to recap season one for me. I went on for about 3 or 4 minutes and at the end of it I thought, well, that's really handy. I know who nobody is.
It's kind of a nonsensical recap, isn't it? Mm,
because there's too much of it.
There's too much. I mean, this is a season like the... for a lot of today, I was trying to, in my head, think what I would say when I sat down here in front of the microphone, how I would describe what the plot of it is. And it's so hard to describe what the plot of it is because the idea of the Wheel of Time in general is this idea of a great wheel that turns and history turns with it. And basically when it's kind of finished its rotation, the people who die are reborn as new people. So that's like the general scheme of things. But then within that, you have all of these separate groups of people like the Aes Sedai, who are these mystics who can channel powers. You have this search for a person called the Dragon Reborn, which is what season one was all about. They found the Dragon Reborn at the end of season one. And now what you're doing is you're kind of into this ensemble adventure of what happens now that they're kind of dealing with the consequences of the end of the last season.
Well, give us a sense of Rosamund Pike, first of all. Who is she? Because she's very important to the plot. She's in an awful lot of the first episode of season two. And she's pivotal to the overall organisation of the series.
Yeah, so she's one of the kind of pivotal characters in it. So in season one, she's basically an Aes Sedai. I mentioned them earlier. They're these mystical women and they basically can channel these powers. So they're very powerful women. They can kind of, you know, kill people, bring people back to life, heal them, all that sort of stuff. She, for season one, was searching for this person called the Dragon Reborn, believing that the Dragon Reborn could basically defeat the Dark One. Now, this is a high fantasy series, so stick with me. A lot of these words won't make sense,
Reborn,
right?
And the Dark One, we kind of know the good and the bad.
Exactly, exactly. So she went on search. She felt that there was these five young people who lived in this village called Two Rivers, and she felt, okay, one of them, I believe, is the Dragon Reborn, but they're all a bit special in their own way. By the end of that season, they discovered one of these people, who's called Rand, was the Dragon Reborn, and he had to face off against the Dark One in this big fight at the end. And Moraine, who is Rosamund Pike's character, accompanied him to this fight. At the end of this particular fight, what actually happened was he did defeat the Dark One, but he also managed to kind of let free, I suppose, a minion of the Dark One who has really bad powers. So he's now roaming around the world. And this particular person also removed the powers of, it's called the One Power, the big powers that Moraine has. So now Rosamund Pike's character is power free. So she's dealing with these powers. The guy Rand, who was the Dragon Reborn, has run off into the distance and told her to tell his friends that he's dead. And the rest of his friends are trying to live their lives. One of them has run off. He's called Matt. One of them is kind of with this band of merry gentlemen. And two young women are training to be these mystic Aes Sedai women in the footsteps of Moraine.
Basically,
so if you followed me there, fair play.
Look, the season two, the problem is there's still a dark force out there and we still need the help of the Dragon Reborn to fight the dark force. That's kind of where we're at.
Essentially, exactly. And I mean, Moraine is trying to figure out how to live life without these famous powers that she has, and she wants to try and find Rand, the Dragon Reborn, again. She needs to kind of get hold of him. She also has a character who's her warder, who's played by Daniel Henney. His name is Lan. And the two of them have this kind of symbiotic relationship where as her warder, he kind of cares for her. They were really close in season one, and now the relationship is fracturing, in part due to the fact that she's lost her powers, but also you suspect she's holding back things from him. And then the two young women who are training to be mystics, they're living in this place called the White Tower, and they're both figuring out their way around the world too, because one has really strong powers and one doesn't quite.
There's a touch of it, and particularly in those younger characters, there's a touch of, this is Jeff Bezos is putting the money into this, and obviously he wants somebody else made Game of Thrones, I want my Game of Thrones, that's what's going on here. But there's also a touch of The Handmaid's Tale in the way those the younger women are treated, and there are older women in the baddie in the red dress.
Yeah, there's a lot of the older Aes Sedai women. They can live basically forever. They're really long lasting, and they have a lot of control over these young people. So a lot of the series is about dealing with those elements of control as the young people try to figure their way around in the world and try to figure out how powerful or not they are. But I really think if you're someone who's not into high fantasy, you will struggle to figure out what is going on. I had to go back and rewatch things. I googled loads of things, loads of articles didn't even make sense about it. If you're someone who gets really invested in it and you love things about the Dark One, the Power, the Wheel of Time, this, the other thing, you will just dive into this and love it. But watch season one before you get to season two, because like you said, that recap, I didn't have a notion what I was getting. And I had seen most of season one and I still couldn't figure out what was going on.
All right. Cork is all over the programme. We just had Stevie G on from Cork talking about
Stevie G, great fella. Yeah.
Cork woman yourself.
Yeah.
And there's an actor from Cork involved in this series.
There is Donal Finn. So he's playing a very pivotal character called Matt, who's one of these five young people. And Donal Finn is replacing Barney Harris, who played that role in season one and kind of disappeared off during the COVID times and didn't come back. Donal Finn is great. His character isn't on screen a lot, but he lights up the screen when he's there. He's really energetic and he's got this lovely dynamism about him. It's not just because he's from Cork.
Just checking.
I swear. He's great because he's not given that much to do, but you can tell there's something exciting coming with him. So I really enjoyed that character because some of them can be very dour in the show.
Yeah,
not a lot of laughs.
There's a lot of deep talking about the Dark One is
the
coming.
Dark
you know, and you think, yeah, okay, well, let's get on with it. But let's listen to a scene that features the aforementioned Donal Finn as the character of Matt.
Yeah.
And he's speaking here to Kate Fleetwood, who's one of those older Aes Sedai
women. Yeah, Aes Sedai. Yeah.
But she's a bit nastier than the Rosamund Pike character.
She is.
Yeah. So here they are talking. She's one of the Red Sisters and she's reading a note from Matt's, Donal Finn's former friends. And she's kind of been a bit nasty to him because that's what she does.
Let's promise that next year, the four of us will celebrate together. Loial and I could meet you two in Tarvalon.
Now that must be painful. A dozen letters now, not a single mention of Matt Cawthon.
I suppose it would be difficult to forgive you for abandoning them.
What do you want from me?
Naivety doesn't suit you.
I haven't touched that dagger in 6 months. I am not a threat to you. Or your Red Sisters, or Moraine, or the entire bloody world.
There we go. That's Kate Fleetwood as Leodrin and Donal Finn. Cork actor as Matt in a scene from Wheel of Time. Aoife Barry with me in studio this evening. I was saying as we were listening to that clip, the problem I had with that the first episode, and I think it's kind of true of the whole series, Aoife, from what you're saying, everything seems so important. There's nothing that's kind of a nice, gentle throwaway scene. Everything is epic.
Yeah.
Everything is all about the Dark One and whether the good will overcome evil. It becomes quite taxing and wearing.
Yeah, like the tone is kind of the same the whole way through, and you feel like every single sentence of dialogue is weighted with like some portentous idea behind it. You know, even in there's two young women in it who kind of a new character comes in and she befriends Egwene, and they have a nice dynamic. You can tell something's happening, but you also feel like every single conversation they have is this really heavy conversation that's got all these layers underneath it. And because a lot of the language in it and words are obviously completely made up but sound a little like English, you kind of end up confused. You're like, oh, a trolloc, what's a trolloc again? You know, what's this word, what's that? So you do need subtitles on, I think, as
but
well when you're
I'm
watching
guessing
it.
I'm obviously this is based on the Robert Jordan's best-selling novels.
Yeah,
I'm guessing if you're a fan of the novels, you'll probably love this, and it is a kind of a Marmite thing. You love all that epic fantasy stuff, or you'll just run 1,000 miles from
it. I really think so. Anything I've read that's been written by a fan of the books, absolutely, they absolutely love it, really feel that it's bringing to life something that they just adored. You know, they're really long books, so they're for people who are really, really into this particular genre, and that's great. I think it obviously there's a lot of fan service there in a way. The world building is beautiful, the costumes are gorgeous,
it looks so beautiful. Yeah, it does look brilliant if you knew who everybody was.
Yeah, exactly.
It might sound brilliant too.
Exactly, you can enjoy the dress glasses that Moraine wears. But I think you will really struggle with this if you don't understand who these people are or what they're doing. And I couldn't really get invested in a lot of what was happening. There were maybe one or two moments where there was peril to the level where I thought, oh, I'm interested in seeing where this is going. But because I know there's loads of different books, I know that there's an end point really that like it's not getting to maybe with the series. Now, there are only eight episodes per series, and they do promise that some characters that people don't expect and that didn't die in the books are going to die in the series. And there's some interesting things happening in episodes 3 and 4 that did pique my interest a bit more than 1 and 2.
Is Jeff Bezos going to make any money out of this? And does he care? Is it a vanity project?
It's definitely, you know, a vanity project in terms of the fact that he's really into it. But I mean, you know, he has the money to invest in something that he's obsessed with. And it's great to see more art being made. But he's also swimming in a swimming pool of dollars. So it doesn't really matter to him whether or not it's good or not. But the quality is obviously a lot better than it could be if it was just simply a vanity project.
Can you recommend anything about it apart from that the dresses are nice?
I mean, what it does is it takes a really huge series of books and it really does make a decent stab at turning that into an understandable narrative, but it's not that understandable if you're not into that genre.
All right, and season 3 has already been confirmed. So
if
you're going to get invested quickly.
Yes.
Aoife Barry speaking to us about The Wheel of Time season 2 premieres 3 episodes on September the 1st with new episodes following weekly on Prime Video. And that is our lot for this Thursday evening. Great to be back with you, as I said.